This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. Congress has been working on healthcare overhaul for nearly a year, and attempts to pass the bill may be stalled. Public disapproval of some portions of it, and the Democrats losing their supermajority in the Senate, has put the effort in limbo. President Barack Obama wants to take to the airwaves with a bipartisan group to talk about healthcare and what compromises can be made. Also, the Tea Party had its first national gathering, and there's debate on what the short and long-term impact of this political movement will have. It's Politics Day on Talk of Iowa. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson will be by to talk about these topics and more, and take your phone calls and emails. Talk of Iowa, coming up after this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. The Tea Party held their first national gathering recently. We'll talk about whether that is a one-time fad or a movement that will have political consequences. Also, President Obama wants to take to television and a bipartisan meeting to try to save the idea of health care reform. This is Talk of Iowa. Joining me this week, as always, is Stephen Schmidt, ISU's political science professor, who's joining us from Florida. I hope it's warmer down there, Stephen.
Oh, no, there's a blizzard going on here. But this is a sand blizzard. Yeah. How are you? Good morning. It's nice to talk to you.
And Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire political analyst. Arnie, are you on the line with us?
I am. And it's a pleasure to talk to you, Jack Aul. Oh, no. That was on my hand. It says Jonathan, not Jack. I had to cross off the notes on my hand. Excuse me. Everybody will understand that in about 37 seconds, but I'm fine.
Well, let's start by talking about the Tea Party. They got together and had their first national gathering in Tennessee. They had an impressive slate of speakers. The question is, what does that say about that movement? Is it going to be a legitimate party? And what impact do we think they're going to have on the national discourse?
I think they have almost hijacked the national discourse, regardless of what exactly it is they are or want to do, because they are fascinating, passionate, irreverent. They've scared the Democrats into sort of a small panic. The Republicans are pretending that they are just absolutely delighted with this, although we hear that the Republicans are themselves, the establishment Republicans, somewhat taken aback by this, because you don't really ever want to get on a beautiful horse that you think you're going to ride across the countryside, but where you're not sure that you're actually steering the horse or it's taking you where it wants to go. So it's an evolving kind of an organization, and I think it'll be fascinating to watch it morph itself over the coming months, really, because it's just beginning.
Well, can I say something? I've just got a press release from some folks about what to do about the bonuses, and where do you tax Wall Street bonuses, and what should we do about all the issues that has everybody angry. What's so interesting to me, Stefan, is that the teabaggers are angry about a lot of the same things that people on the left are angry about. But the people on the left somehow think that they're not supposed to show their anger because, after all, Barack Obama is president, the Democrats control the Senate, the Democrats control, the House of Representatives, and therefore, if they're angry, they just have to be angry at their computer screen. The liberating thing that a lot of conservatives and Republicans have is that there's no leader. And therefore, they can be angry, and they can point to government, they can point to Congress, they can point to Wall Street, they can point everywhere, be angry, and have this sort of Velcro that brings people together with their anger. And I think that's problematic, because there is both equal anger and equal frustration on the left as there is on the right. Only one would never know it, because you get 600 people showing up at $500 a pop for a teabagger convention, and it gets more press than practically, what happened with the Super Bowl.
That's the dilemma. You've now used a term to describe members of the Tea Party twice now that is really kind of that members of that party find incredibly offensive. And I'm wondering, well, you called them
conservative and Republican?
No, you called them teabaggers, which I think
I'm sorry.
I think is is, but I mean, clearly,
what term should I use?
Maybe members of the Tea Party.
Of the Tea Party. Okay.
Yes.
Members of the Tea Party. I will use whatever language is appropriate. I know I won't use the word retarded because I'm not allowed to use that. Only Rush is. But I will, and I'm not going to say that about them. My point is that they are legitimately angry. They are legitimately angry. I am angry too. But there is no place for people like me to be angry. But there is now an outlet and a place for people like them.
I think
that doesn't show that there is a frustration across the board in this country about what is happening to our nation, what is happening to our lack of investment, what is happening to the change that we wanted to believe in. And everybody on both sides wanted change.
Is there now, I mean, is this the benefit of being in the minority, is that regardless of your political ideology, that when you're in the minority, you have the benefit of criticizing what is without offering an alternative plan? Because at the Tea Party convention, there was a lot of tapping into this political philosophical notion that government should be smaller, that government should be hands off, that government should do less, that taxes should be lower. But there was no platform on how you accomplish all that. So, Stefan, maybe from the political scientist aspect, is this just the exercise of being in the minority party where you have the benefit of just criticizing what's going on and not being held accountable for an alternative proposal?
You know, I guess I'm not sure that there isn't some substance there, because basically reducing the size of government was the platform of Ronald Reagan, who very successfully transformed American politics. The fact that people in this particular very complex movement have that as a major theme doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be written down in the law and that you can't begin to implement it as public policy, I think. And, you know, so I think there is a convergence between what the protest movements are talking about, what they're angry about, and public policy. It's not clear that the Republican Party is interested in implementing some of the reforms, because these folks are also angry, as Arnie said, at the behavior of large banks and corporations and mortgage companies and so on, because many of them have been the victims of that behavior. But the Republican Party seems reluctant to lay down how it would address those concerns, because the Republicans really are still seen as the party that basically started this bailout and that is, partly responsible for the banks and others getting a lot of taxpayer money without having to reform themselves. So, there are public policy possibilities in the kind of discussions that people in this organization have had, but it's not clear that they themselves are going to run for office, that they themselves are going to implement it. So we'll have to see how that develops over the next month.
And Jonathan, there's a disconnect because nobody is being honest about the math. And what do I mean? In the end, math is important, and I think it's obviously been an American weakness that we're not strong on math. Just take a look at our SATs or our ACTs. But there's a couple of things. First of all, let's go back to Ronald Reagan. Since Ronald Reagan has become a deity, he was no longer a human being. He was not even a president. He is now a saint. Well, Saint Reagan had large deficits. Enormous deficits. It didn't bother him that he was creating deficits because he knew that we would get beyond it, that America could suffer the consequences of deficits and move forward, that they were a necessary part of governing. How come we've forgotten that? How come we have forgotten that? And the other thing is, what was it, 6 out of the 8 or 5 out of the 7 budgets that Ronald Reagan presented to Congress were actually larger than the budgets that Congress ultimately embraced and adopted? Wait a minute, what about that math? I mean, there's a problem with that aspect, and then there's another problem that happened at the convention over the weekend, and that is that they rail against health care reform and they want to shrink the size of government. But one of the things you keep hearing over and over again, but they can't touch my Medicare and they can't make cuts in Medicare. Now, I don't know what anyone's thinking here, but last time I checked, Medicare is a government program. Last time I checked, we are more concerned about Medicare bankrupting us as a nation than we are about Social Security. How come nobody put a psst excuse me, and sort of reminded them of that and say, how do you address that aspect of your anger and frustration?
Well, let's go back to the Reagan administration and the point that you brought up there. And going back to the issue of the benefit of being in the minority party was at the time Congress was controlled by Democrats.
Right.
And so there wasn't a launching point for the opposition to just throw out whatever they wanted because their party was responsible in part for it because you had a Republican president and Democratic Congress. Now you don't have that. So is it easier to launch those missiles and not do the math, I guess, is the point.
It's always easier. I mean, it's the beauty of my dad was so cute. He said to me, he said, you know, you can run and become and say all these wonderful things as a candidate. He said, but the real test of who you are is when you're put in a leadership position and you actually have to enact the things that you said. It is tough for Barack Obama to move from campaign into leadership. It is, however, not tough to go from winning to losing, because losing is liberating. Then you can say everything because you have no responsibility ultimately to come up with the policies because you can claim you only have 41 votes. See, isn't it interesting? 41 is now powerful, but ultimately people hear 41 compared to 59 and they think, oh, look at how weak you are. But in the end, they actually have power. The only way they choose to use it, however, is to say no and not to find policies to lead.
Stefan, do you think anything will come of these proposals, that the Tea Party will coalesce into some kind of platform that someone would try to implement?
Well, you know, the Socialist Party in the 1920s in the United States offered specific alternatives, and the Socialist Party was a third party, and they have a very hard time in the United States, but their program for solving some of the problems that were accompanying the Depression and so on, economic inequality, were so compelling that they began to grow and attract people, and it scared the Democrats into changing their party platform and philosophy that eventually resulted in the New Deal. The New Deal was really the co-optation of socialist and actually even communist party, which was growing too, concerns. So these third parties or movements, and the Tea Party isn't really a party. It's kind of a movement. They don't seem to be running candidates themselves and so on the way political parties do. They can often, if they connect well enough with public opinion and if they're riding the top of the wave of public concern, they can transform one of the other parties, and I'm guessing that may be one of the most significant ways in which they will actually do this. The other thing that Sarah Palin, at least, who seems to be...
And, Stefan, we're going to have to get to Sarah Palin after
sure.
this quick break. We have to take a quick break after it. More on the Tea Party and Sarah Palin. And your phone calls and emails, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or call us at 866-780-9100. We'll be back in a minute. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stefan Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are with us. We're talking about politics and the Tea Party movement specifically and their convention this past weekend. We also want to hear from you. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org is the email address, or you can call us at 866-780-9100. Let's start by going to Mitch in Des Moines, who wants to talk about Sarah Palin. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Well, yes. I mean, Tea Party movement calls themselves a nonpartisan, but as was noted, most if not all the speakers this last week were members of the Republican Party, including Sarah Palin and former Congressman Tom Tancredo from Colorado. And with Mr. Tancredo, I mean, he was calling basically for a literacy test for people to vote, and he was saying that the folks that voted for President Obama could not even pronounce the word vote, let alone say it in English, and he called them a committed socialist ideologue. I mean, how does that get votes or support across party lines? I mean, when most, if not all, your speakers are bashing Democrats, including the President of the United States, and, you know, and he's Tom Tancredo was a keynote speaker on the opening night on Thursday evening of last week.
I can make a comment on that. I think, I mean, I remember going back to the Christian Coalition, and the Christian Coalition back in the early 90s, although they said that they were nonpartisan, made a decision quite early on that their goal was to basically take over the Republican Party in 30 out of 50 states. That was what Ralph Reed talked about, was that their goal was not to become partisan, but to ultimately take over and have such significant influence over one party, and the party that to them made the greatest sense was the Republican Party. And to a large extent, they were very successful at it. I think what you're seeing right now is that this movement is also looking at which party right now lacks leadership, is in somewhat of a void when it comes to policy, was sort of underperforming for the American people. And after, obviously, the election, it looks like the Republican Party, and there is a relationship and a nexus and a void right there, and that's why they think they can influence it. Does it mean that they're partisan? I think they want to create a partisan result, but they want to define what partisan means, because it's going to be Republican under their lens, not Republican Party as it exists today.
Well, I think if you took a survey of the participants at the Tea Party National Conference last week, that you would probably, I would say you probably find over 95% were registered Republicans or Libertarians.
Well, it's $500 a pop. I think that's probably true.
Very true. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Mitch. Stefan, do you think that are moderate Republicans the people that might be at most vulnerable if the political leanings of the Tea Party get a greater foothold?
Moderate Republicans are as concerned about, I think, sort of black and white solutions to problems, anti-immigration bashing, which the caller is absolutely right. Tom Tancredo failed miserably in the Iowa caucuses and in his ill-conceived bid to become a presidential candidate, in part because even though people are concerned about illegal immigration, immigration is a transfusion, has been since forever in the United States, of new blood, new people, new ideas. Much of it is legal. Many of our engineers and scientists, if you start looking at rosters of professors in engineering colleges in the United States and so on, they come often from other places, and the entire American space program was really a transplant of the German rocket program with Wernher von Braun and others who came over here after the war. And so to bash immigrants in a country where everybody is a descendant of an immigrant is not a winning direction, really. It appeals to a small segment of the population, but not independent Republicans, who I think generally view the world in a little bit more complex way. And independent Republicans sometimes vote for moderate Democrats as well. So I think if the movement lurches too far in the direction of the most passionate of its members, then I think very likely it will shrink and not grow. And that's what a lot of Republicans that I talk to who want to win elections are saying. You know, the problem with the Republican Party has not been that we don't take a clear position on issues and aren't conservative enough. The problem is that the tent has to be big enough for us to win elections. And it doesn't matter, you know, how pure your position is. It makes you feel good. But if you don't win elections, you're always on the outside shouting in. And so I think that's the delicate problem that both parties are going to have. How are they going to go to the independent voters who are ambiguous about a lot of things and say, our candidates really fit your philosophy the best? And I think that's what happened in Massachusetts, as I understand it, with Scott Brown, is that he was not, you know, the Tea Party may think they had a victory with him, but as Arnie and others, myself, have pointed out, boy, he doesn't fit the Tea Party's clear-cut position on issues very well at all. All he did was he defeated a Democrat, but he is not consistent with most of their positions, I don't think. And that's, I think, how in Iowa itself, the Republican Party is having a huge soul-searching discussion of which of the remaining three or four candidates for governor, for example, would best bring the independents in Iowa, the no-party voters, to the Republican candidate in the general election? Would it be someone who has a clear-cut conservative position who can really, you know, stemwind the base of the party, or would it be someone who's a little more wishy-washy about those issues and has other, you know, other strengths as well besides social issues? And they're struggling with that, frankly. And I think the Tea Party just adds to that conversation, which is they really want to purge the Republican Party of Republicans like John McCain, you know, who is being challenged essentially in Arizona by a radio talk show guy and a former congressman who is more conservative than McCain, and the Tea Party is saying McCain actually talks to Democrats too much, and he has a long history of consorting with the enemy, and we want somebody who is more pure. And so if that's going to happen, it'll make it a very, very interesting November elections. Actually, make it an interesting primary season.
Well, and I think
independents don't vote in the primaries. That's the real problem.
I think the same thing happened with Senator Grassley, is that because he was at the table with Democrats, a lot of people questioned his sincerity to the movement. Let's go to Chris in Waterloo, who's on the line. Chris, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Yo, hi, thanks for taking my call. What I wanted to comment on is the huge, you know, disparity in attention between different movements. There was, you know, a very large anti-war movement, you know, starting from around the fall of 2002 and even 2001, all the way through the Bush presidency, that really, you know, I'd been to many, many conventions were far larger than the 600-person Tea Party. And, you know, demonstrations, at least 7 or 8 of them, that ranged in size from 100,000 to 500,000 people. And there just wasn't the attention. But I, you know, like to hear comments on why that is.
Stefan, let's start. Do we agree with the premise? Stefan, Arnie, do you agree with that premise that this is getting more attention than the anti-war message did a few years ago?
Movement got huge, huge, huge press, and it dominated the political scene more even, I think, than this movement.
Well, let me tell you why the anti-war movement did not get the same attention, because we don't have universal draft. Because the people that died and the people that went and the people that protected us volunteered to do it, and it wasn't necessarily your kid. And your kid's neck wasn't on the line because we don't have it. So the anti-war movement could be angry, and they could be right, and they could get a lot of attention, but they didn't necessarily touch your life. This movement, however, talks exactly where you live, about the job you're losing, the health care you're losing, the 401k that now looks like a 101k. It is talking directly to your experience and the experience of every single American. And that's part of the reason why it is getting attention. The other reason why it is getting attention is that it has a huge echo chamber. And the echo chamber isn't just Hannity and Fox and Rush and O'Reilly, you know, which are on the air, you know, 15 hours a week on a million stations around the world, but they also have an echo chamber called the Chamber of Commerce. Okay? And that's part of that's the difference. There is a lot of money on the line right now. Not a lot of lives, a lot of money. Money makes a difference.
And you mentioned healthcare. When we come back from our break here, we will talk about healthcare and Barack Obama's. The president looks to go to TV to have a bipartisan talk about healthcare. We'll talk about that after this break on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Still interested in your emails and phone calls, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can call us at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull.
Yeah, gasoline prices are a lot higher than a year ago, but they should be somewhat stable this year. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Energy analysts say we've got a glut of oil, and that means gasoline prices probably won't spike too much this year. Rebecca Williams has been looking into this. What'd you find?
We're paying anywhere from 70 cents to a dollar more per gallon than we were a year ago, depending on where you live in the country. The good news is we're not likely to see $4 a gallon gas anytime soon.
We're not in a world with runaway oil prices.
That's Rushir Kadakia. He's a global oil market expert with IHS Cambridge Energy Research Associates. He says weak global demand is keeping oil prices in check for now. At the same time, supply is relatively high. He predicts oil won't average much higher than $80 a barrel for the next year or so. It's about $72 a barrel right now.
Probably through 2011, we shouldn't expect to see gasoline prices much above $3. unless it's for a short period of time, maybe in the summertime for a few months.
Kadakia says oil speculators can drive prices higher or lower in the short term, but he doesn't think we're going to see any major price spikes over the long term.
Well, the good news is we're not going to be paying higher prices for gasoline. The bad news is there's no incentive to go buy good mileage cars.
Yeah, probably not.
All right. Thanks, Reb.
You're welcome.
This is the Environment Report. At the beginning of the year, federal tax credits expired for building bioenergy plants that turn everything from wood chips to algae into energy. We're already years behind what they're doing in Europe, especially in Germany. Sadie Babbitts takes us to one German plant that makes green energy on a massive scale.
Crews work on what looks like brew vats. But instead of brewing beer, these vats are for brewing energy from fermenting rye, manure, and bacteria.
Basically, we're standing here in front of the biogas and the biofertilizer production area. The big fermenters there are for the biogas production.
Oliver Lutke is a chemical engineer for Verbio, one of Germany's largest commercial producers of biofuels. Lutke's been helping turn this ethanol facility into a plant that makes ethanol and biogas. That's methane.
We convert nearly everything into energy by using biological processes. This combination of biogas and bioethanol production plant is not existing in the world.
That's what Verbio claims anyway. The company buys grain from thousands of regional farmers. The grain gets turned into biogas and ethanol. Lutke says the company has the technology to make this industrialized-sized plant profitable. That baffles skeptics because it costs a lot to make green energy. By the time you make 1 gallon of biofuel, oil is cheaper. Bioenergy researcher Jan Liebetrau isn't convinced Verbio has the answer.
Because you put otherwise lots of energy into the system and you get out bioethanol, which might be, from the energetic point of view, not valuable anymore.
So making bioethanol costs energy, which defeats the whole purpose of producing it in the first place. Oliver Lutke at Verbio doesn't see it that way. He says Verbio has the technology to make biofuels without losing energy. And because the company's process is more efficient, Lutke says they've cut down on greenhouse gas emissions.
We emit 200,000 tons. The plants we are using will eat off 180,000 tons of this, and then that's a closed cycle.
It's not perfect, but there's less greenhouse gas being released than from burning fossil fuels. And companies like Verbio will help Germany toward its goal of becoming the first industrialized nation to be powered entirely by renewable energy. It's a goal Germany could reach by 2050, well ahead of the U.S.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Joyce Foundation and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are here on Politics Day, taking your emails and phone calls. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org, 866-780-9100. We're going to now talk about President Obama's plans to try to get together a bipartisan group, have them talk about health care, and put it on television. Some people see it as a great step to move forward to some kind of compromise. Other people see it as delaying the inevitability of the need to start over or even shelf health care reform. We'll get back to Stefan and Arnie in just a second. Let's start with a couple phone calls. We're going to start with Karen in Grettinger. Karen, what's your take on health care reform and the president's plan to get some people together to talk about it?
First thing is I don't want to see the thing shelved and just forget about it because we have a problem. Second is, I don't like how they're doing it. If they're going to go with one of the plans that they've already approved in one place or another in the government, the reason being is I'm afraid that this is such a huge bill that in the future, if they see problems with it, they will fail to address the problems, just like they've known about health care being a problem for years and years, yet did nothing about it. And so what I'm in favor of is reform in the way of limiting lawsuits, allowing insurance companies to compete across state lines. I'm against giving unions special favor, AARP, Planned Parenthood, giving money to states so they'll vote for it. I'm against all of that, and I think that if we do a huge revamp of the whole thing, that there will be problems with that, and they won't fix them. And one final comment is there are many children who are out there who are being insured by the states through Medicaid because they are parents of a single parent. The parent who is supposed to be paying child support doesn't, and a parent who's supposed to be carrying health insurance for the children doesn't, and then the parent is forced to sign up for Medicaid as a result of it. I think that they should go after the parents just like they do if you were on welfare and say, okay, your child's on Medicaid. You are required to pay us back the cost of insuring your child. And also, if a parent was to receive child support, this could free up money for the parent who has the children to go ahead and pay for private health insurance. I had my children personally on Medicaid for a while, and I was able to free up some bills that I had. And I chose, even though I qualified for Medicaid, I chose to put my children on private insurance to alleviate the responsibility of the state at a time that I did not receive child support. Having said that, many parents don't do that. If they can qualify, they're going to take advantage of it. I don't believe the states are doing enough. Now, my fix
Karen,
to that
Karen,
problem...
Karen, thank you. Karen, that's a lot to go with. Let's try to get Steph and Arnie in on this. Thank you very much for your call. Steph, Arnie, Karen gave kind of an opening salvo of how she feels. What do you think of her comments, and is this proposed meeting going to solve anything?
Number one, the proposed meeting should never be happening because the Republicans have just tricked Obama once again into basically letting the minority party be the majority party. They have, I don't think, any real interest in health care reform. What they want to do is slow this thing down, and they've managed to probably do that. But what the other thing is, the caller should go and see my piece in InsiderIowa.com on Iowa health care reform, because Jack Hatch, who is one of my former students, is the lead in the Iowa legislature. And you know, frankly, at the state level, political leaders and public policy makers are throwing their arms up in the air and saying, we've had it, the federal government is not the best and only place for health care reform to take place. It is so politicized. It has such a target painted on its back. Why don't we start doing some things at the state level that are more innovative, and we can do those better because we're closer to our constituency. So I urge people to watch the development of alternative health care reform initiatives at the state level. And I think if Obama managed after an entire year of health care reform kind of being ping-ponged back and forth across various parts of the legislative process, and it still, you know, isn't a score, it's very unlikely that he is going to be able to get much more done with that now. I just am very pessimistic about it. I don't think the Republicans see it as a winning proposition for them. I don't think Obama has made it very clear what health care reform he actually would sign off on. And, you know, even the Democrats still are not clear. It's another effort, such as the effort to put together a bipartisan group to look at how to reduce deficit spending and the national debt and so on, which the Republicans also are seeing essentially as a trick for making the catastrophe that is going on in this country a bipartisan catastrophe, whereas they would like to make it a Democratic.
Okay, so but
Democrats hate to have them called a Democrat catastrophe.
But Stephen, you think that the president is falling into the trap and that there is no real bipartisanism there?
I don't think there is. I mean, the Republican health care reform, proposal is in large part cut the size of the federal government, and one of the reasons why we're going bankrupt is because we have given everybody in this country every kind of health care benefit beyond and above. At this point, did you know, I know, Jonathan, you know this, but Arnie probably doesn't. Now, over 50% of all the health care in the United States is delivered by government. Now, that's not a small health care program. That is a giant, messy, gooey, sticky, expensive, and hideous program. And Obama have to add on to the hideousness and stickiness of it.
Stefan, it's hideous. Because the part that the government covers are the oldest and sickest and poorest of us. If I was in the business of insuring, the only people I'd want to insure are young men between the ages of 25 and 38. And I wouldn't want to insure anybody else, because after 38, they go into heart attack material, and before 24, 25, they're doing all sorts of bizarre behavior because they're young men. Okay, and they don't get pregnant. Here's the good news. I mean, the problem is that what the government eats of the health care dollar is the most expensive aspect of health care. The story about California and Anthem is incredibly illustrative of this. Why did Anthem have to increase their rates by 39%? That's now getting an investigative hearing, and everyone's pointing bad fingers at Anthem. And this is what Anthem said in part of their defense, that a lot of people are suddenly either losing their jobs or finding the cost of health care getting so expensive that people who are healthy are dropping their health insurance, forcing only the sick to be on Anthem's health plans, making it more expensive for Anthem. Welcome to the world of Medicare and Medicaid. We basically cover the sickest and oldest of us, and if the system is imploding, it's because there are no healthy people to offset the federal investment.
But the Bush Medicare drug plan is for middle-class people with a lot of income.
The Medicare drug plan, Stefan, the Medicare drug plan was a wet kiss to the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
There was no, isn't it interesting? The caller before just wanted competition among insurance companies. She wanted them to be able to compete over state lines. Competition is useful only when you choose to even acknowledge it exists. No competition was allowed when it came to drugs, but now they want competition for insurance. Here's the problem. Insurance companies and baseball are the only two industries in the world that are exempted from antitrust legislation. So how do you have competition when you're exempt from antitrust? Competition is a word that has no meaning when it comes to insurance.
Arnie, do you think that if the president is successful in getting together a bipartisan group of people, have a meeting and put it on television, that there will be any meaningful compromise or solution to this issue?
I think both sides are leery. I think what Barack Obama is attempting to do is to do what he did with Republican members of Congress, which is basically show his intelligence and his brilliance and his ability to sort of slap back. And what he's hoping is that the Republicans will come to the table with either a list of grievances or challenges, and Barack Obama will either be able to show that the numbers don't match, that it's not going to result in more expansive insurance policies for people, more affordable policies for people, more accessible policies, whatever the issue is. And so the Republicans are looking at this going, then why should we come to the table when it may not be in our best interest? Because right now, misinformation about health care is what's winning for both sides.
Okay.
Both sides win because most people don't have a real comprehension of a very, very difficult equation, which is called health care reform.
Okay, so Stefan, you mentioned that this plays into the Republicans' hands, and Arnie, you said that the president wants to be able to slap away some of those criticisms. All right, Craig is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Craig, what do you make of this, and whether the president's plan to get people together is going to produce anything?
Well, first of all, I'm a Republican, and I'm adamantly pro-life, but I'm an enigma to the party because trickle-down health care for some brings trickle-down votes, and that is part of the problem, along with the fact that we need to work together as fellow Americans to make things better for everyone, but we don't. We try to make the other side look bad with what they're doing with health care or whatever, either to stay in power, to get back into power, or for money or whatever it is. And it isn't the size of government. It's what God intended the size to be. And so one side takes the perspective, well, we need a smaller government. And they just keep saying that. Well, if you read Romans 13, it doesn't say anything about the size of government. It just says how the people are supposed to function. And so we just keep going the same way.
Craig,
as
someone who wants people to work together to come to a better solution, do you believe that the president and Democrats in Congress and Republicans in Congress, do you believe that if they get together and talk, that real compromise and working together is going to be the outcome?
If they, just like that one lady says, we need preventive medicine for everybody. We need politicians in there that are willing to work together for the good of everybody in America and even the world,
and Craig, do you vote everybody else out? Do you think that's going to happen in this meeting that the president is proposing?
No, absolutely not, because they are so ingrained to do what they've been doing. It's politics as usual. And we need to get a new type politician that will work together with all the other politicians for us instead of what they're doing. They're working for the party. It's the party that's going to solve the solutions. No, it isn't. It's everybody working together, and they aren't doing that, and we need to vote them out and get a whole new type politician in there.
Craig, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Stefan and Arnie, we've heard that very comment from people on this show before, but our system doesn't really make it easy to elect that kind of person, does it?
Stefan just said about John McCain. John McCain is being tainted because on occasion he has worked with Democrats. They are using that as his liability and not his asset. His asset isn't that he can get along. It is now considered the fact that he's selling out. By talking to the other side, you are a sellout. Oh, my God, how pathetic. And if that's how we are going to view it as a nation, if that's how politics is going to be played out, then guess what? How do you expect nations to get along? How do you expect us to get along with the Chinese or the Russians or the Iraqis or the Iranians? I mean, if this is how we perceive Republicans and Democrats, just expand that on a worldview. That's what's so sad about all of this,
well,
you know, is that we've forgotten what governing means.
Arnie, nations don't get along.
Oh, I know. but understand that at some point in time, the rot has now, I think, really overwhelmed us. And part of it, I think the economy has got everyone frightened. And when you are frightened, you have to find someone to blame. You have to find someone to blame. And that's what's made this situation so much more acrid, is because it was one thing to be frightened after 9/11, all right, because 9/11 was this unknown terrorist that did damage. But isn't it ironic? That kind of fear brought people together. A failing economy tears people apart. It doesn't bring them together. It actually circles the wagons, and everyone is shooting at the person across the way. That's the difference, and that ultimately isn't going to help us, especially when we're looking at the fact that we now have to compete with the Chinese and the Indians. And so instead of focusing on the competition, we are actually encouraging the failure.
So what's the next step then? Is it even possible to envision a positive outcome in the next year? What needs to happen?
Well, I think I always say this over and over again, success breed success. It clones success. Barack Obama has chosen not to go to the mat on anything. On anything. And in the end, he has to pick what he wants. He has to make that decision. He has the numbers to win. He does. He has the numbers to win. Now he has to decide what it is he wants to win and then pray that the policy that he has embraced, that he is committed to, that he's using his incredible IQ to embrace, ultimately makes the difference. Because 2 years later, 4 years later, he can point to success. But doing nothing is by definition failure for both sides.
Stefan?
Well, I think the real problem is, in the end, that his agenda was so broad that it dispersed the troops. You know, you can't storm every hill if you've got a limited number of soldiers. And the Democrats tried to storm every single hill that was out there, and Obama pointed them over here to education, and he pointed them over there to health care reform, and he pointed them over there to bailouts, and over there to mortgage stuff, and over here to obesity, and over here to global warming and climate change and cap and trade. And they all tried to run and storm all these hills, and in the process got exhausted, lost their focus. The leadership lost control. Obama never actually led the troops. He was the general who was issuing vague orders about seizing hills and taking, taking ground from the Oval Office, or more often than not from Air Force One, because he's traveled all over the world and schmoozed with people and, you know, kissed rings and kissed hands and bowed to potentates and Saudi Arabian princes and stuff. And in the process, I think Washington, D.C. was left semi-evacuated, and Congress just needs a leader. You know, Congress, the president is not just the leader of the executive branch. He is also the leader of the legislative branch. He is the one who is supposed to send them his legislation, his ideas about what he wants to do, and then say, okay, let's get to work, ladies and gentlemen, and let's do this first and this second, and we've got to get this done. And he didn't take people and show them the edge of the cliff and say to them, you know, we need to work very hard. And then he had an intransigent Republican Party that unanimously blocked most things. I mean, Olympia Snowe and a few others had the courage to sort of say, well, this is something I can sign off on. But the other Republicans said, you know, this is a we're gonna try to regain ground by saying, no, we are not going to send any of our troops on all of these raids up onto these hills and mountains. We're going to say this is bad policy. Obama is a socialist, and the talk radio media, as Arnie repeatedly said, was there to essentially verify the fact that this was an administration that Republicans should never touch, that it was toxic, and that's come to pass. And I don't think anything is going to change between now and next November. Nothing.
But wasn't that strategy, wasn't that the Obama multifaceted strategy, wasn't that at least at some level informed by the expectations of the people who voted for him? Because I don't think that the people who voted for Barack Obama had one or two agenda items in mind. Each of them had one that they felt very passionately about, and they all voted for him, and they all expected him to do all of those things.
But, you know, that's, can I say something? That's the strategy for winning a campaign. Now we have the strategy to govern. And the strategy for governing is not the same as the strategy for the campaign. I recommend everyone go to the Financial Times and read an article by Edward Luce, L-U-C-E. He's their Washington editor. It's entitled America, a Fearsome Foursome. And it's talking about the sort of Chicago cabal that hangs around Barack Obama. And that includes, you know, Rahm Emanuel. It includes, what's her name, Valerie Jarrett. It's very interesting, but the problem is that what he may have needed to do, which is, you know, multitask when you run as the candidate, but when you govern, you have to be strategic. And what is missing is that ability to be strategic by Barack Obama. If he had been strategic and said, I need to win this one, I need to have health care by April, I need to have this, even though I know it's very, very difficult, but you know what? Even the Republicans thought he should get health care. By the time he flim-flammed around and waffled and they realized that he wasn't going to be strategic, that was an invitation for them to say no. And now what's happened is there have been more and more invitations to say no, and they are winning on the no's because he can't get to success.
Let me recap then. So to be politically successful, in the primary, you have to run to the edge of the extreme of your party so that you get the nomination. And then when you run for election, you run towards the center and you promise a big wide range of things. And then when you get elected, you narrow it down to two or three agenda items that you can get through and then have passed. And then when you go to go back for reelection, then you have to widen it way back out and then narrow. Is that the formula?
Well, I think that is the formula.
Well,
you've got politics 101 down to an art, but it's not just politics. It's governing. And as Stefan said, you can't govern and be successful on everything. Then what you have to do is be strategic about what ultimately not only can you be successful on, but what will have sort of affect the gestalt, really touch the whole. That's your job, is to touch the whole. You know, presidents have that job. Senators need to worry about their states. You know, members of Congress have to worry about their districts. But presidents have to worry about the whole.
Okay, all right, we have about a minute left in the show. The out question is, this proposed meeting with this bipartisan group is just that, proposed. It may not happen. If the Republicans boycott, if they do not show up, does that play to a victory for President Obama and Democratic Congress members?
No, I mean, I don't think so, because it just reinforces the fortress and the boiling oil that the Republicans have up on the turrets of saying, no, we can't work with this administration because it is bound and determined to destroy the United States. And so it would be foolish for us to sit down with them and try to work out something. We want them to throw away the entire health care reform and begin from scratch. That's
Arnie, quickly, do you think that's going to be good or bad for Democrats?
I think if the Republicans walk away, they look like they're afraid to face Barack Obama.
That's all the time we have for Talk of Iowa. Stephen Schmidt, Arnie Arneson, thank you very much. Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us.